Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Big E here. This is Law for Virginia Law Enforcement Officers. We're talking about law. What do you need to know as a law enforcement officer in the Commonwealth of Virginia? And today, we're going to talk about a new case from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, a deadly force case, police shooting, where the Fourth Circuit reversed a decision by a federal court to dismiss this lawsuit and reinstated the lawsuit for alleging an unlawful use of force by police officers who shot an armed man who had come out of a house. He had a history of assault, and he had some mental issues. He'd been diagnosed with paranoia. He came out of his house with a gun. The officers ordered him to drop the gun. He did not drop the gun. They shot him. The district court dismissed the case, and the Fourth Circuit reinstated it this week. So I want to talk about this case, and I want to talk about not just the facts of the case, which are a little bit murky, to be honest, but I also want to talk about how the court framed and talked about the previous cases from the last 30 years, and what I think it tells us about how the court is viewing law enforcement deadly force decisions in 2023. I think we're going to see it's very different than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. The court's looking at these decisions very differently and being much more exacting on law enforcement. And so how they've changed, and we're going to look at several cases from the last 30 years. We're going to go all the way back to Slattery versus Rizzo, the Fairfax County case, and we're going to kind of walk through a bunch of different cases as the court does, and see how the court is changing its view of law enforcement deadly force decisions. Because I think it's an interesting chance to do that. So what's this case about to start with? This is a case from North Carolina. And the facts of it are a little bit confusing. So what I've done here is, in the show notes, I'm going to put the links to the body camera videos of the primary and backup officer here. It's kind of difficult to understand exactly what happened here if I give you a verbal description of it. And the body camera, I think, really helps understand, although obviously it doesn't give you all the facts. It does at least help to kind of understand what happens. And it's all very quick as well, of course. And the officers are pretty far away when they shoot the individual in this case. So, you know, check out the show notes, check out the links. The videos are kind of hard to find. I really had to spend, it took me, you know, a good bit of time to track them down. You can't just easily Google them and find them. So anyway, that being said, what happens? This is a case that begins with the plaintiff himself calling 911. The guy who gets shot ultimately is the one who calls 911, and he calls because he wants to turn himself in for some charges he has, and he wants police to come pick him up. He was facing charges of misdemeanor assault, and the assault was by pointing a firearm at somebody, and also simple assault. He didn't have any other criminal history, but that's a pretty, you know, serious misdemeanor charge. He'd been recently diagnosed with paranoia. He was not a danger to himself, a danger to himself or others, but he was diagnosed with being paranoid. And when the 911 dispatcher asks, why do you want the police to come pick you up? He said, because I have a gun in my hand. Now, the communication between the 911 operator and this fellow whose name is Galindo are entirely in Spanish. And that'll become important later. But the dispatcher, when he hears he has a gun, says, what are you going to do with the gun? And he says, are you going to help me? Or are you not going to help me? And she said, well, again, I kind of need to know what your plan here is with the gun. And he says, well, look, tell me if the officers are coming or not so I can put my firearm there in front or whatever. What's your name, sir? She asks. And he says, my name is El Dios Estrella, which means the star god. And she's like, nah, it's not really helpful. I need like your, you know, name, that your like your legal name that we do know you back. And he gives him Galindo. And he says people are following him, police officers are following him, he can't take it anymore, he's been drinking that day. He says, look, I just need the officers to come for me, I will be outside the apartment, I just need them to take me, but I need somebody who speaks Spanish. I want to turn myself in, I don't want to hurt anybody, and I want the officers to lock me up. The 911 dispatcher, understandably, is very concerned about the firearm and says, where is it? And he says, it's in my bag, and if you want, I'll take it out. No, absolutely, do not do that. Leave it in a safe place, the dispatcher says, and when you see the officers, show your hands. I don't want you to have the firearm. Do not have the firearm with you. Please leave it for your safety and everybody else. I need you to assure me you're going to leave the gun behind. Please put your gun someplace else. So the dispatcher is adamant about these instructions. He, however, Galindo, keeps saying he's going to have his firearm with him when he meets the police officers. And he says, as long as the officers don't shoot me, I'm going to throw the gun. And he's giggling a little bit, which is a little strange here during the call. But he says to the dispatcher, look, my gun doesn't even have bullets in it. I don't have bullets. He says about 11 times, I don't have bullets. So officers are on the scene, and they're waiting for a Spanish-speaking officer to arrive so they can talk to this guy, because obviously he's got some problems understanding instructions. But at some point during the call, they can hear a woman's voice in the background yelling, and they become concerned that this woman is in some danger since he's armed, paranoid, had a history of assault, and has assaulted somebody with a gun. So four officers approach the residence, and they call out for the for Mr. Galindo to exit. And so he's standing at the door, he's standing in the doorway, he's facing the officer, he has his arm down at his side, and the officer starts yelling out, manos, which is in Spanish means hands up. Now, the officer, before he'd gone out, had sort of rehearsed that if you know, want somebody to raise their hands, you say manos arriba. He just says manos, manos, but he's raising his hand in the air to indicate he wants him to raise his hand in the air. At that point, Galindo, the plaintiff, raises his left hand, and the officer sees that he's got a handgun in his hand, and he's got it about waist level, at which point the officer switch over to English and starts screaming, put it down, drop the gun, put down the gun. And at that point, instead of putting the gun down, the plaintiff raises his arm above his shoulder and extends his arm with the gun in his hand past the end of the screen door that's open. He kind of reaches out with the gun and holds the gun way up in the air, kind of like his arms are kind of in a surrender position, but he's also holding the gun out, which is the opposite of what they're asking him to do. But his arm is extended about 45 degrees out, so he's kind of waving or holding or showing them the gun. And again, the officers are screaming, drop the gun, put it down, drop the gun. And so he raises his right arm then so that both of his hands are kind of out in a sort of forward surrender position, like either, you know, kind of like worshiping a sun god or surrendering or whatever. And with his arms out like that, holding the gun, the primary officer shoots the plaintiff twice, killing him. Now, this is all captured on body camera, kind of. The officers obviously are behind cover. The officers are engaging with rifles rather than handguns, so they're at a rifle distance, not a handgun distance. So if you watch these videos, you know, you're going to see somebody kind of very far away, and the officers obviously are using their naked eyes as well to spot this guy. So what they see and what you see is going to be very limited, you know, what they're able to make out and so on. It apparently, if you watch these videos very carefully, you should be able to see, or at least one of the officers was able to see, that he had the gun, he was holding the gun upside down. In other words, he wasn't holding it with his hand wrapped around the grip and his index finger on the trigger. The gun was upside down so that he was holding it. He could still fire it, I guess, with his small finger, but he had the gun upside down. So the plaintiff's estate, he dies, and the plaintiff's estate sues the officers. The officers appeal to the district court, and the district court dismisses the case, finding that there's lack of sufficient evidence, and based on qualified immunity, the officers did not violate his clearly established rights. It goes to the Fourth Circuit, and the Fourth Circuit reinstates the case and says a reasonable jury could view and interpret the video footage, consider the other evidence, and decide that Galindo did not pose an immediate threat to the officer, or a reasonable jury could define that the officer mistakenly perceived he posed an immediate threat, but the mistake wasn't reasonable. And so a jury could conclude that the officer used excessive force in violation of the Fourth Amendment, which means he doesn't get qualified immunity if a reasonable jury could make that conclusion. And so here, regarding this issue, the court says, they rule in this case, it's clearly established that an officer violates the Fourth Amendment by using deadly force against a suspect who is holding a firearm in his hand and ignoring commands to stop the weapon, but who is standing still in a position of surrender, is not firing the weapon or aiming it at any person, and is not otherwise making a furtive or threatening movement that would suggest he had an intent to use the weapon to harm the officer or anybody else. Instead, here the court says, the failure to obey commands by a person in possession of or suspected to be in possession of a weapon only justifies the use of deadly force if that person makes some kind of furtive or other threatening movement with the weapon, thereby signaling to the officer that the suspect intends to use it in a way that imminently threatens the safety of the officer or another person. So here it's important to note the court is not saying, and therefore this use of force was unlawful, but what they're saying is a jury could find that. The jury also could find that the officer acted lawfully here in this case. The court certainly didn't have to believe the plaintiff in this case. Then he said, I'm just trying to surrender the gun and I just want to, be peaceful. And I don't have any bullets. All these statements here, there's reason to be skeptical about him. And the court acknowledges that. But there's a lot of criticism here of the officer's commands. If the court is going to find that someone brings about an officer's use of force by virtue of failing to obey commands, the court says those commands have to be clear. And here, the court criticizes the officer for not using clear commands, using the word manos rather than manos arriba. And then when he raises his gun, the officer switch over to English, which means he may not understand what they mean. Rather than waiting for a Spanish-speaking officer, waiting for a crisis intervention officer, and so on. Again, the court criticizes the officers, doesn't say, and therefore it's unlawful, but does say, and therefore a jury could find that it's unlawful. And again, the court views Mr. Galindo's actions in raising his arms as a position of surrender in this case, that he could not have fired the gun from that position, even though the gun is raised in the air. When he first, what's interesting here is the court looks at it and says, when he first comes to the door and he raises up the gun to his waist level, at that point, the court says, at that point, deadly force might have been justified. Not necessarily, but the court says, even if, we're not going to examine that in this case, but even if deadly force was justified at the moment that he brandished the gun at first, the court here rules that the justification would have vanished once Galindo assumed that surrender position. You cannot use deadly force against somebody simply because they are armed and they've ignored commands, in the words of the court here. Yes, an officer doesn't have to wait until a gun is pointed at them until the officer decides to take action, but there has to be some basis other than the suspect's mere possession of a weapon and a failure to obey commands for the officer to feel reasonably threatened. And so again, there's a statement that there has to be some furtive or threatening movement with the weapon, signaling that the officer, signal to the officer that the suspect intends to use the weapon. And here, the video seems to indicate that he's shot when he's frozen in the position of surrender, not making any furtive or other threatening movement that would signal an intent to imminently use the firearm, to use the gun that he had in his hand. So yeah, a jury reasonably could find that the plaintiff did pose an immediate threat, but in this case, it's not sufficiently clear that they could dismiss the case. And in doing so, the court really goes back and looks at, and also Judge Richardson, who dissents in this case, goes back and looks at, 30 years of deadly force cases, going all the way back to Slattery versus Rizzo, which is a case from 1991 in Fairfax County. Now, Slattery, if you don't remember this case, this was a case where narcotics officers are doing a buy-bust operation, a sting operation in a parking lot. It's an open-air drug market. There have been lots of incidents involving weapons and violence. Within a couple of days, they had done operations where they'd recovered guns off of people. And in fact, they had planned to do operations on the day of this on the day of the shooting in this case, but they had to cancel them because there was a drive-by shooting the night, just a few minutes before officers showed up on the scene. So they had to, completely redo what they were going to do because there had just been a drive-by shooting within hours. So all that being said, They do four or five buy bust operations at night, and then this car pulls up to sell drugs to an officer. Slattery is the passenger. The plaintiff is a passenger in the car. And an officer, when the officers swoop in to arrest everybody, one of the officers walks up to the van, blocks up, the van is blocked in. He gets out of the vehicle. He approaches Slattery, the plaintiff. He shines a flashlight through the window. He can't see his hands. He says, "Police, show me your hands. Police, show me your hands," at least twice. The plaintiff fails to respond. He kicks the car window. At that point, the plaintiff turns his head slowly, looks at the officer. The officer opens the door and says, "Police, get your hands up." He's got his gun out. He can't see. Remember, Slattery's a passenger. His left hand, that hand is away from the officer, but he can see it's closed around an object. And Slattery looks at the officer and then looks away. Again, he says, "Put up your hands." Slattery then turns his entire body towards the officer, who can't see his left hand, and he's got the left hand behind him. And then at that point, he shoots Slattery. He shoots the plaintiff, and it turns out to be a beer bottle. And in this case, the Fourth Circuit says a reasonable officer could have probable cause to believe that the plaintiff posed a deadly threat, and therefore deadly force was authorized. This is a four-page opinion. And you know, it's not even full four pages. It's really three pages when you look at the, you know, we take out all the little like headings and stuff. So it's a three-page opinion in this case, whereas the opinion, you know, with the dissent in the case from today is 67 pages. That alone should tell you something has changed in how we look at deadly force. Then we go to a case called McLennigan, which is a 1994 case. Again, about 30 years ago, officers are doing a sobriety checkpoint on the Richmond Expressway near a toll plaza. And during it, again, tells you something about 30 years ago, the magistrate has brought a gun to do the booking of the operation, to the booking room. So the magistrate, she has a revolver just sitting on her desk, just loose, sitting on a desk. And officers are bringing in arrestees, and then the sheriffs are taking them back out towards the jail, and they're kind of just got this little assembly line going of arresting people, taking them through. At one point, one of the prisoners breaks free. Now, they've all got handcuffs. They're all handcuffed in front of their bodies because they're being booked into the jail. So they've got, and they're getting ready to go into the bus to go to the city jail, so that's how they're handcuffed. One of the deputies breaks free, jumps from his seat, dashes past the deputy into the magistrate's office. And at that point, the deputies realize, oh my God, where's the magistrate? She had just gone to the bathroom and she left her gun sitting on her desk. So at that point, the deputies start yelling about the prisoner who's escaped. He's got a gun, he's got a gun, he's running. And so McLennigan, who's not the guy who's tried to escape, but he hears, you know, gun, he's got a gun. McLennigan runs away because he thinks he doesn't want to get shot. He starts running away and running down the hallway towards an officer. So now a Richmond police officer sees this prisoner running. Because he's got his hands shackled, he's hunched over, so he can't see whether he's got a gun or not. But he can hear deputies screaming, "He's got a gun! He's got a gun!" And he's running away, and so the deputy wheels around and shoots the fleeing prisoner. McLennigan survives, but sues. And in this case, the court says, yeah, a failure, you know, the officer says, you know, put up your hands, right? So they agree his failure to raise his hands in compliance with the command can support the probable cause that the suspect is armed. In this case, he couldn't raise his hand because he was shackled. But the court says it's not required to require a police officer to actually detect the presence of an object, of a gun in somebody's hands. In this case, the officer reasonably believed he was armed. He's getting either yelling that he's armed. And in this case, the court says it's unfortunate, but this is an understandable and reasonable mistake, and so dismisses this lawsuit. Again, that's 1994. And this is a 7-page opinion. Very short, you know, not a lot of consideration given into it. Going to 1998, though, we have a case called Sigmund versus Chapel Hill, North Carolina case, where officers here in this case are summoned to a 911 call for a domestic dispute. Sigmund is inside the house. He's angry. He's drunk. he's been laid off his job. She tells police that he doesn't have any weapons, but then says actually he's got a knife. When the police get there, Sigmund says, get the hell away from the door, screaming, you better get down the road, or I'm going to cut you. I'm going to cut your heads off. I'm going to kill her. He breaks a glass window. He throws objects at the police. So the officers start to form a perimeter around the house. He calls the officers MFers. He says, I'm going to kill you. He's throwing objects at the police again, reaching through the window with his knife. If you want me, come and get me, but you're going to get hurt. Finally, while they're waiting for a SWAT team to arrive, he gets out of the house and starts walking towards the officers, who see a knife in his hand. He's disheveled. He's bloody. And they're screaming, drop the knife, stop, drop the knife. He says, no, go ahead and shoot me. I want to die. He's ignoring them. He's walking up to them. He keeps walking. And he gets about 10 feet away from the officers, 10 to 15 away from one of the officers. And that officer shoots him twice. At that point, he dies. And the officers say, you know, we're trained. 21 feet is the closest you let someone get with an edge weapon because they can cut you or kill you. They cite the 21-foot rule. Now, of course, the 21-foot rule concerns someone's ability to close distance before you can draw and fire your weapon. This officer had already had his weapon drawn. But the court in this case dismisses the lawsuit and says a police officer doesn't have to detect the presence of an object in somebody's hands before firing on them. But this case, where an officer is faced with a split-second decision in the context of a volatile atmosphere about how to restrain a suspect who's dangerous, who's recently and potentially still is armed, and is coming towards the officer despite the commands to halt, here, the court says, the officer's decision to fire was not unreasonable. In this case, the plaintiff's family were saying that Sigmund didn't have a knife. There was some argument whether he had a knife or not. I mean, they see the knife. All the officers say they see a knife. They get the knife off him when he's shot, but the family says he didn't have the knife. Either way, the court here says it's reasonable to think he's got the knife. And, you know, this is a case, again, in 1997. What's interesting here, or 1998, excuse me, what's interesting is when Wilson versus Prince George's County, which we talked about on this podcast before, comes out 20 years later, in Wilson walks towards an officer about 10 or 15 feet away after breaking into an apartment, threatening his girlfriend with a knife. She exits the apartment. She calls for police. The police officer comes up, draws a gun, says, drop the knife, drop the knife. Wilson's closing with the knife and he's stabbing himself. The officer shoots Wilson, and the court in that case says it was not a lawful use of force to shoot somebody when the person is only threatening to use the force against themselves, saying, get out of here or I'm going to stab myself. Now, they dismiss the case against Wilson because they find that they had not clearly established that rule. And clearly, if you look at Sigmund, it seems pretty clear from the court statement here in this case that somebody who is dangerous in a volatile atmosphere, who's armed and is coming towards the officer despite the officer's commands to halt, court says that's a lawful use of force. In Wilson, the officer's following that rule, and then the court changes into Wilson, the rules have changed. But when I say the rules have changed, I think looking at rulings in the 2000s, you start to see a change in the way the court approaches deadly force. In Anderson versus Russell, this is a case still kind of in the 90s. The court looks at this where an officer shoots someone who appears to have a gun but doesn't have a gun. But when we get to 2013, we get to Cooper versus Sheehan. And in Cooper versus Sheehan, police respond to a 911 call of an altercation at Cooper's property. They get there. The call is that they can hear two men screaming at each other. Officers pull up. Now, according to Cooper, and this is all, everything I'm going to say here is according to the plaintiffs, not according to the police. The police would say something different. But the plaintiffs claim that the officers don't activate their blue lights, don't activate their sirens. They pull up. They can see somebody standing on the porch, and they can hear screaming. So they park at the edge of the grass. They walk up on foot. They can hear an argument outside. They come up to the house. They tap on the windows, but they don't announce their presence. They don't say who they are. And so Cooper, when he hears the banging on the window, you know, utters some obscenities, peeks out, grabs his shotgun. He points it. He's got it pointed towards the ground. He opens the back door, and the officers now are nearby, and they're walking towards the porch. And one of the officers stumbles over a concrete block, and that's when Cooper, the plaintiff, walks out with his shotgun. At that point, when the plaintiff, the homeowner, comes out with his shotgun, the officers immediately draw on fire, shoot him, he collapses. So in that case, the plaintiff sues, and the question here is, did the officers have a lawful use of force? The court here says the mere possession of Mr. Cooper of a shotgun isn't enough to permit the use of deadly force. An officer does not possess the unfettered authority to shoot a member of the public simply because he has a weapon. Instead, deadly force can only be used by an officer when, based on a reasonable assessment, the officer is threatened with the weapon. And in this case, you know, Cooper is coming out of his house to figure out what the noise is outside, because he hears this noise outside of somebody outside of his house. He doesn't know who it is. The officers haven't announced they're police. They haven't put on their sirens, their lights, or anything like that. They're just outside his house making noise. And then we have the Hensley case from 2017, where officers again respond to a domestic disturbance. Hensley and his daughter are having an argument, and they're arguing outside on the porch. Now, again, these facts are going to be entirely according to what the Hensleys say, not what the officers say. Officers are going to say something different. But when this court case comes to the Fourth Circuit, the district court has dismissed the case, so the Fourth Circuit is supposed to look at it from the in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs and let them have their chance to have their day in court. They're not trying the case. They're just deciding should the case be dismissed or not. So according to the Hensleys, what happens is Hensley, they agree, Hensley's got a handgun. Police show up and they don't take any action. They don't announce their presence. They don't tell him to drop the gun. They watch as Hensley struggles with his daughter and someone else and actually strikes somebody with the handgun. At that point, Hensley walks off the porch and into the yard towards the police officers. He looks back at his daughters on the porch, and he had the handgun in his hand. He's got it with the muzzle pointed to the ground as he's walking towards the deputies. Hensley and the deputies don't acknowledge their presence. He doesn't raise the gun towards the deputies. He doesn't make any overt threats. Officers never order him to stop, drop the gun, or issue any type of warning. And the officers in this case concede that they never actually spoke to him. So even the officers will say they didn't say anything to him. But when he walks down the porch and walks towards the yard, the deputies walk out, get out of their vehicles, shoot, and kill Hensley. So again, Hensley sues in this case. And the court looks at this and says, because a jury crediting the plaintiff's version of the facts could conclude that the deputies were not in any immediate danger when they fired their weapons, the failure to warn Hensley weighs against them. They don't say anything to him, right? In the moments leading up to the shooting, the deputies watched Hensley descend the steps and from the porch into the yard. They watch him pause and look back at the house, and then they briefly watch as Hensley walk towards him. While this scene played out in front of him, the deputies concede they never ordered Hensley to drop the gun. They never warned they were going to shoot. While we have no doubt the circumstances confronting the deputies were tense and fast-moving, that alone doesn't obviate the need to warn somebody if feasible under federal law, right, under Tennessee versus Garner from 1985. And so the court concluded the district court correctly denied the request for qualified immunity and find that a jury could, at trial, conclude that Hensley never raised the gun, never threatened the deputies, and never received a warning, and therefore the deputies were not in immediate danger and were not entitled to shoot the plaintiff in this case. So going back to, two more interesting cases. We have Nibs versus Momford, which is a 2022 case. That's a case where police again respond to a dispute involving neighbors. A law enforcement officer responds again. He knocks on the door. He doesn't get a response. He can hear the plaintiff loading a shotgun by racking it. The officers here haven't announced their presence. They haven't said who they are. They've just knocked on the door. So when he hears the plaintiff rack the shotgun, he says, "Drop the gun, drop the gun." The officer tries to run off the porch, but the plaintiff points the shotgun from the window and he shoots and kills the plaintiff. And in this case, the court says there's factual issues, whether or not the plaintiff would have recognized him to be a police officer. Did he announce himself? Was he knowingly pointing a gun at a police officer, or was he just pointing it at somebody who's come onto his property in the middle of the night, banging on the door? Court says a police officer cannot use deadly force against a homeowner who possesses a firearm inside his own home while investigating nocturnal disturbance, but does not aim the weapon at the officer or otherwise threaten him with harm. And if the officer cannot if the officer doesn't sufficiently identify himself, then again, you know, what's the lawful fear for his life? And then we have this case from, again, from North Carolina, Allman versus Charlotte, which is this week, and the case Franklin versus Charlotte, which is a case from April. And we could talk about Franklin versus Charlotte at length, but that's a case, I would just encourage you to check out, it's episode 86 of the podcast. And we talk about Franklin versus Charlotte at great length and talk about a bunch of these cases as well. So definitely check out episode 86 on the Franklin case. So with all that in mind, you can see, I think, how the way the courts have looked at law enforcement use of deadly force has changed, or you know, how the courts have, depending on how you look at it, refined or become more strict or been more exacting to law enforcement about deadly force in the last 35 years in the Fourth Circuit, although the court will claim over and over again that it's not changing the rules, it's just stating what the rules are and always have been. In his dissent, Judge Richardson very much rejects that and says, you know, the court is changing the rules here, but the court does not agree with that. The two judges who reinstate this case do not agree with that. So I hope today was interesting. I hope today was helpful. Check out the other episodes of the podcast, definitely episode 86. And of course, we have a lot of episodes about use of deadly force and use of non-deadly force. But for today, that's all from me. That's all from Big E. Until next time, stay safe and don't get captured.